From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, artists are dropping out of one of the most important exhibitions in contemporary art in protest over toxic philanthropy. Then in the film Cher, a teenage girl tries to piece together the night she was sexually assaulted, and it's not clear what she should do with what she learns.
You know, in some ways, I think it seems a lot easier to people to be an advocate or an activist or a public face of your painful experiences. And I don't think that it is.
And a comedic podcast about the Mueller report prepares for tomorrow's big day. All that coming up on The Frame.
This is Larry Mantle. Join me for our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights, 1970s LA's porn industry in transition. Saturday night, July 27th at the Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.
More than 2 months after the Whitney Biennial opened in New York, eight artists have pulled their art out of the exhibition in protest. The issue is a moral one, namely how one prominent board member for the museum makes his money. Jerry Saltz is the senior art critic for New York Magazine, and he says the Whitney is a particularly significant show to be at the center of this controversy.
For almost 100 years, the Whitney Biennial has been a kind of a watershed. Every other year, the Whitney Museum picks about 30, 40, 50 American artists and says, this is what art is now. And then the entire art world takes a look, and so does the whole world, and has a big argument and kind of sets that up in the art world. This biennial is incredibly historic. It has more than 50% women and more than 50% artists of color for the first time, which makes this the biennial people have fought for decades, and now it's here.
One of the installations in the show is a video called Triple Chaser by a group called Forensic Architecture, and it's a video that aims to explore how weapons produced by Whitney Vice board chair Warren Kander are used around the world. That piece seems really significant to what's going on right now. So what is the relationship between Warren Kander's work at Safariland and what's happening right now?
Well, directed by Laura Poitras and narrated by David Byrne, basically this short documentary-like video sets out the evidence for how some of the ordnance made by Warren B. Kander's company, Safariland, has been used by the Trump administration against people crossing into the United States. It's pretty serious ordnance, tear gas based. They also go much further and show how the same ordnance was used in Palestine as well as Afghanistan. So suddenly, toxic philanthropy is the subject of the entire thing.
And so what happens? What becomes the fulcrum that changes the conversation? Because a lot of the artists probably knew that, and if they even looked at the installation, would have known what Warren Kander's has done. So now we have, what, eight artists who have withdrawn from the installation, from the exhibition. What changed?
What happened is, first people protested in letters and petitions. Then weekly protests began in front of and once or more inside the museum. And finally, last week, it just came to a boil. The irony of museums is the boards hire the director, so the director of the Whitney has absolutely no legal authority to get rid of Warren Kander's. This billionaire will not simply step away, and the board is not forcing him to leave or making a strong statement saying this is who we are.
We're talking with Jerry Saltz, the senior art critic at New York Magazine. Has Warren Kander said anything about the dispute?
Well, he's basically saying, let's not make everything in life political. But that is not the issue. What's really at issue is not Warren Conders, is not the Whitney, and not the Biennial. It's that almost all of our museums are awash in what you might consider toxic philanthropy. I mean, there's a Murdoch on the board of the Dia Art Foundation. MoMA and the Met have much more conflicted trustees. The point is, it is time for a real conversation about this. It does also mean that if we cannot have this sort of philanthropy, then staffs will be cut. So will programs. But what is the moral price for not having this very difficult public important conversation?
And that feels like that's the conversation some of the artists are having, and that's why it took a while for them to withdraw their installations. Because as you say, and as you wrote about, there is a lot of dirty money funding a lot of museums around the country. But that is where a lot of money is. So yes. What are the next steps? Does that mean that art museums wash their hands of their biggest donors? I mean, what is the end game of all of this?
No one group, it's important to understand, no one politic, no one group gets to dictate the politics and ethics and the principles of every museum. That is not what's required. But art and money have slept with each other since the beginning, John. And museums built on the sweat and the back of artists and art lovers must not be placed at the mercies of, you know, plutocrats trying to cleanse their money by putting their name on the fountain in front of the Metropolitan Museum, like David H. Koch. We are at yet another crossroads where systems are broken.
So what happens to the Whitney show? Are people going to go see it? Are there protests outside of the museum itself? Is it going to end sooner than anticipated?
Here's the tragedy of it, John. This is the biennial everybody's fought for half a century. Majority women and artists of color. And now we have calls for them to step away from the museum and boycott. Now, everything's conflicted when you walk in that museum, insofar as what is the show, who's in, who dropped out, what's right, what's wrong. And all of these filters are obscuring the work that we want to see.
Jerry Saltz is the senior art critic at New York Magazine. Jerry, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks, John. Keep up the great work.
Coming up on The Frame, writer and director Pippa Bianco makes a movie about a teen sexual assault and the related fallout on social media. A quick heads up that this next segment discusses sexual assault. The movie Cher is the first feature by writer and director Pippa Bianco. It's about a 16-year-old girl. She wakes up with no memory of what happened to her the previous night, and pretty soon a viral video confirms her worst fears. The story is inspired by a real event between adults involving a man Bianco knew. He had a consensual but private encounter, which he shared online without the permission of the other person.
That story, for me, was really difficult because this person was a very good friend of mine. And I was horrified, I think, to think like, oh, wow, like if even this person, you know, who cares very deeply about the person he's harmed as well, if even this person is capable of dehumanizing someone in that way, why? Why is it so easy to do? So I think that was sort of what got stuck in my mind, that question of, you know, that this isn't something that, like, marauding, evil, very visibly identifiable villains are doing to other, you know, innocent people. It's something that people who care about each other, you know, regular kids, are doing to other regular kids. Not that that in any way affects how, you know, how wrong or painful the act is, I think. But I wanted to know why it was so pervasive and so easy to do.
Right. There's that whole sense of, like, boys will be boys, or that there are ways of behavior that are unacceptable that become talked about in acceptable ways, right? And I think that's part of what happens in the film. So I'm going to play a clip, and it's where Mandy confronts her crush, AJ, after the videos come out to ask what has happened because she doesn't remember.
Why would you video that?
I didn't.
Who did?
I don't know. But it's funny. Well, I thought you'd think it was funny. You thought it was funny when we duct taped Dylan naked to the couch. So.
Just tell me what you did.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting to me about that scene in particular is I don't think at that point in time she has or hasn't been assaulted or knows one way or the other what's happened to her. I think that that video that he's talking about is of a much more complicated, grayer form of humiliation that in that respect isn't gendered, I think, in a lot of ways. To me, I think it was actually important that, like, particularly in AJ's performance, that there was part of you that also wanted to see the humor in it. You know, like when I was in college, if someone passed out drunk first at a party, like, you know, that was, they were going to get written on marker or whatever other, you know, there was sort of like a prank culture of, like, humiliation that is really complicated. And so to me, I think, like, you know, while it may not be funny to me and it may not be funny to her, you know, like that example he brings up of them humiliating a boy in their friend group and that being something she could laugh at, that it is part of a broader culture.
I think it's a fair point. And it raises this other idea that the video is kind of evidence that she has been the victim of something, but it also isolates her from her own story, and that what is happening to her is almost beyond her control. It is something that's unfolding on social media. It's unfolding with her parents, and that she doesn't have any agency. And it feels like you also make a choice that she's not going to do what we would often see in movies like this. She's not going to go after the guy or become, like, the investigator of her own life.
Well, I think it's more that she's not going to do those things because that's not who she is. To me, it was really important to humanize and dignify what, you know, the choices that most people do make. I think that was actually something I thought a lot about making the feature film. It's like, if, you know, in some ways I think it seems a lot easier to people to be an advocate or an activist or a public persona or a public face of your painful experiences. And I don't think that it is, you know, I think it's also very tempting to feel like it's over, you know, to feel like, okay, we've done it, it's easy, people can do it now, we've created a culture and a climate in which people can do it, so they will do it. But by and large, most people, you know, choose their privacy. And I don't think that's any less of a heroic or valid choice to make.
Do they choose their privacy because they want to do that or because they fear that they won't be believed?
I think it really depends on the person and the case. I'm sure it's both. You know, I'm sure it's really complicated. But yeah, I mean, I think there's also a distinction between, like, who is she telling? Are you telling people in your intimate life, or are you taking a more public platform?
We're talking with Pippa Bianco, who's the writer and director of the film Cher. I want to play another clip from the film, and this really gets to the idea of what men believe and what women believe and what kind of understanding they can bring to a situation like this. This is a conversation between Mandy and her mom. And her mom, Carrie, is explaining to Mandy that her father doesn't really have the same basic understanding of sexual assault as she does.
You have to remember, it's different for him. He thinks this is not normal. I knew things like this happen. I know things like this happen to someone every minute of every day. And I know they happen here. But he didn't know that. Because he didn't have to.
Because he didn't have to. That seems like a really important line. What are you trying to get at there?
I had all sorts of conversations with my parents about how to be safe in all sorts of scenarios, from like riding an elevator to going out at night. You know, it was like a constant kind of refrain. And that is, I think, really problematic and sad. And then, you know, it sort of means that a certain set of people like carry this fact and burden around with them. And then there's a large number of people who don't, by virtue of just not being vulnerable in those ways or having access to that lived experience. But yeah, for me, I think Mandy's mom is just kind of saying that, like, unfortunately, this isn't news to her. This isn't surprising. Like, unfortunately, this is something that is familiar to her because it's probably part of her lived experience as well.
And I think it's also fair to say that women and men who are victims of sexual assault go through two assaults. One is the assault itself, and then the second is the assault on their credibility and why they're saying what they're saying and whether or not what they're saying is true. And we certainly saw that in the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. And there's a moment in this film where Mandy and her parents meet with the police, and the police explain basically what they can and cannot do.
Well, you still have to prove that whoever it was using their phone at the time, that it's definitely her in the photos, that she didn't do it herself.
That's definitely not her. So you're just going to drop it now?
It's not us. The DA decides.
Do you know any more about what happened now than when we started?
Nothing definitive like that, no.
And it really feels like even the things that you might turn to for relief and help in situations like this aren't necessarily going to help you.
I think part of the issue for me is that the law hasn't really caught up yet to people's lives. And so that, you know, that officer is well-intentioned and is saying things that are true, you know, that these are like, you know, the frameworks we have, like video voyeurism is a brand new crime that doesn't even exist in all states. You know, like that's the word they've kind of come up for it in New York State. And I think the very first revenge porn case, I think was being prosecuted by a New York City DA this year. So there's all sorts of frameworks we just lack to talk about Mandy's experience. So whether it's, you know, I don't even think in this instance he doesn't believe her. I think it's more that she's being failed by a bureaucratic system that doesn't have a name for what happened to her and doesn't have a framework yet for how to handle it.
Pippa Bianco is the writer and director of the film Cher. Pippa, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Cher premieres on HBO on July 27th. Coming up next on The Frame, a comedic but well-informed podcast about the Mueller report gets ready for Wednesday's big hearings. There's a podcast called Mueller, She Wrote, and yes, the name is a takeoff on the old mystery TV series starring Angela Lansbury. The podcast combines serious analysis of the Mueller investigation with a dose of partisan comedy. The executive producer and main host is a woman who only goes by her initials, AG. There's more ahead on why she doesn't use her real name. But on the eve of Mueller's testimony before Congress, I called up AG to ask her how she's preparing to cover tomorrow's hearings.
We've mostly been covering, everything that Mueller handed off. And then, of course, now we've been anticipating his upcoming testimony, which is tomorrow morning, I think beginning at 8:30 on the East Coast.
So 5:30 our time, getting up early.
Yeah, quite early.
And what have you been thinking and talking about heading into the appearance by Mueller in front of two committees tomorrow?
Mostly we've been tempering our listeners' expectations on what Mueller may or may not go into, because I'm worried that people are expecting him to stand up and say, Trump committed obstruction of justice, Trump colluded, even though collusion's not a word in the art of law, but he did, you know, he's just not going to do that. He said he's not going to do that. And I think that Trump and Bill Barr in the Department of Justice are purposefully hoping that we are expecting more from Mueller than he's willing to testify for.
And when we last spoke, you had talked about pressures for your job. And I wonder if you can update us on whether or not that is still an issue for you.
That is ongoing, and I'm unable to talk about it at this time. That's all I can really say about it, but I appreciate your concern.
And for people who don't know, we call you AG. Why do we use your initials and not your real name?
Well, there's something called the Hatch Act. Kellyanne Conway is familiar with it. And it basically says that as a federal government employee in the executive branch, you cannot use your title or agency to campaign for or in opposition to somebody running for political office. And Trump, you know, filed the paperwork to run for office the day after he got into office, mostly so he could make money on campaigning, but also probably for this reason. So it's not actually a violation to use my real name, but some of my lawyer friends and I got some legal advice that I should not even come close to towing the line, so I use a pseudonym.
Because you are a current federal employee?
Correct.
Newspapers, radio stations, cable news channels will all have their instant analysis of what was said and maybe what was not said. When you think about what Mueller, she wrote, can do tomorrow, what are the kinds of things that you'll be looking for as you're watching his testimony?
Well, first of all, I wanted the Democrats to approach this differently than they are. What they're doing is they're giving everybody 5 minutes to question special counsel. I wanted them to have one or two expert prosecutors in there to ask questions, much like they did in the testimony in the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford. They had that one woman in there for the Republicans to ask questions because you have a more of a continuity and there's follow-up and things like that. But the Dems decided not to do that, so that's not what's happening.
It's a fundamental question, but I think it goes to the heart of what Mueller, she wrote, is trying to do as a podcast. And that is, how do you combine comedy with politics? Where do you find the opportunities to make jokes or to crack wise about a situation that is incredibly serious?
Gosh, with this administration, where do you not find comedy? There's just so much of it, and it's more of kind of like the situation where if we don't laugh about this, we're going to cry. But the whole point was to keep people engaged, to put this into entertaining layman's terms so that people stay engaged and care about what Mueller says. Because with all of the pushback and the delays, you know, I mean, our justice system moves at a snail's pace, and it's designed that way. It's designed that way by the framers of the Constitution. Our government moves slowly. And so we just kind of want to keep everybody engaged and interested. And the comedy part, I mean, maybe it's just because we're comedians and it's inherent in us to joke about these things. But I don't think that any subject is off limits when you need to make things humorous or find the humor in things.
You have done how many episodes of the podcast now?
We're at 90 full episodes, but with all of our bonus content and book reviews and daily things, we're up over 150 now, I think.
Did you ever think there would be this much content once you came up with the idea for the podcast?
No, not initially, but it became apparent early on that there was just so much here that one could spend the rest of their life doing podcast series on everything involved in this investigation.
When I think about people who are using kind of a comic twist to look at politics right now, I think of people like Stephen Colbert. I think about John Oliver. What do you think it is that you and other people who have a comic bent can do to illuminate issues?
Well, first of all, we're allowed to speculate and we're allowed to be biased. And so there's always that. I mean, we do report the facts, but we do always make clear when our speculation goes outside of what we know to be already reported fact. But I think the important part here about comedians is that the court jester has always been a symbol and literal, you know, literally someone who would speak truth to power. And it's been going on for centuries. And I think it's we have a proud tradition of that as comedians.
AG is the host, along with Jaleesa Johnson and Jordan Coburn, of the podcast Mueller, She Wrote. AG, thanks so much for coming back on the show, and have fun tomorrow.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That's our show for today. And you can find the Frame podcast wherever you like to listen. And you'll see that we've added a new episode each and every week. It's the Frame Weekend, and it includes the best stories of the week. I'm John Horn in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow.